Happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Today we're going to talk about birds and bird music, the songs and the calls of birds, with a couple of great guests. John Fyth of Madison with me in the studio, as a matter of fact. He is the great to have you. We got some bird songs in the background there.
Let's see. Oh, that's the beautiful song of the hermit thrush.
There we go. I tell you what, John has produced a CD, Bird Song Ear Training Guide, Who Cooks for Poor Sam Peabody. He's also produced the DVD Birds, 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 an Indoor Birdwatching Field Trip. And so it's great to have him here. And also Steve Bechkal with us by phone. Steve, hi.
Hi, Larry. Hi, John. How are you guys?
Well, great.
We're out in the woods right now experiencing the hermit thrush.
Steve is from Eau Claire. He's been chasing birds for about 40 years. He's the author of the book All of This and Robins Too, a guide to the 50 or so best places to find birds in Wisconsin. He writes about birds for the Eau Claire Leader-Telegram, regular columnist for the Wisconsin West magazine. He blogs and has a website, which is www.manymorebirds.webs.com. So I tell you what, it's great to have these guys back. And great to have you listening in. Give us a call with your questions or comments as we move along today. What have you been seeing out there in your yard or in the woods? We'd love to hear about that. If you have some questions, please let us know. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. And again, we'd love to hear from you. And you know, guys, this time of year, I'm seeing a lot of hummingbirds around my feeder. Isn't this really the time of the year that they start really trying to beef up a bit, and the young start getting ready to?
They gotta get fat so they can fly those thousands of miles and even fly over oceans, which is one of the more amazing things in the world of nature, I think, how a hummingbird can cross the Caribbean and still make it. But yeah, now they're getting fat. Now they're actually moving around a lot more. So like in my backyard, I usually don't see hummingbirds until right around now. They a lot of flowers are finally blooming so that hummingbirds can feed from them better than instead of using just sugar from the feeders.
And what about you, Steve?
Well, I have to add, it's amazing that hummingbirds can get fat on flower nectar. I can't imagine how that's possible. But, you know, they're not like us. They build up the calories. It's true. There are reports in Louisiana that a hummingbird will just shoot by over the heads of people, and it's already headed across the Gulf. And how a bird that small can survive on things like that, although they do supplement their menu with spiders. I had one around my trumpet vine the other day, and so if you have a yard full of tube flowers, they really do like those, especially red-colored tube flowers. But yeah, up here, I've been working too hard. I haven't been birding enough. But if you get around the state right now, it's shorebird season. I would say that in another 3 weeks, the songbird migration will be in high gear. Right around Labor Day, things really pick up. Things like swifts and nighthawks will be moving in big bunches through the state. But songbirds, too, will be creeping through the hedgerows and woods very shortly now. But for now, it's shorebird season. You got to go out to the mud plant.
It's also a good time to find rare vagrants that have come from all over the state. Like hummingbirds usually will, there's usually one or two that decide to go north for some unknown reason, and we find them in Wisconsin. 2 years ago, I think it was the mango, the first time ever. And this year, if you see a bird that doesn't look quite like a ruby-throated hummingbird, you should call it into the Wisconsin Society of Ornithology, and I bet you'd get a bunch of bird watchers checking it out. Right now, the big thing is a mottled duck, which is all the way from Florida. I think one of the first times in Wisconsin just popped up north of Madison, and people are going to see it. And so right now, some birds are just confused and decide to go north instead of south.
Well, I have. We've had a great blue heron on our pier hunting fish off our pier for the last, a good share of the summer, actually. It's always funny. Once in a while, he'll come walking up on the lawn, look around a little bit, and then walk back out on the pier and commence his hunting.
Well, you're a lucky guy.
Yeah, it's really, really a lot of fun. You know, Viril in Spring Valley has a question for us, so let's just go there. Viril, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. It's not really a question. I spotted what I am sure is a blue bunting.
Yes.
Which is very rare, not sighted before in Wisconsin, usually down by Mexico. And I think what I've seen is a nesting pair of the blue bunting with a young male.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, I saw three birds in all. Two of them are blue and one is the brown.
All right, now, Verl, I heard about this. You don't have a photo, though.
I don't. But I'm hoping that someone will get a picture of it.
Have you seen them again since the first time?
I saw them this morning.
Mm-hmm.
I was walking this morning and saw them. So it's the third time that I've seen them.
Now let's clarify. The blue bunting is a bird that's common to the south of Mexico on both coasts, usually in the lowlands. So having one here is very unlikely, though not impossible. And it is probable that these could be indigo buntings, but a picture would solve
not
all because
indigo blue.
Yes, they have a indigo bunting compared to the blue bunting. The blue bunting has a whole other profile. It has a larger head. It has a bigger, thicker, more curved bill. So the blue can be tricky in certain lights. But if you get a picture and we can see that profile of the bird, the big head, the big bill, then we can tell it apart. And I think that would go towards documenting it. So yeah, I'd love to run out there too. I did hear about this morning, and I would love to run out. I'm only about an hour away from there, but. But, yeah, if you can get a picture of these birds and send it to me or someone and we can verify, then that would be a big step.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
You're going to have to carry your camera around with you, Averill.
Yes. Unfortunately, my camera is in someone else's hands right now.
Well, I'm sure somebody will come and take pictures because if it's a first record for Wisconsin, there's a lot of Wisconsin bird watchers who would be very interested.
Yeah, I figured there would be, and that's why I'm calling.
All right. Thanks, Verl.
Mm-hmm.
Appreciate it very much. All right. So Spring Valley area. Are you still there? We just lost her. I was going to ask her exactly where.
Well,
you know,
she'll
they just
contact.
Celebrated UFO days in Elmwood nearby there, and so the aliens could have abducted a blue bunting and carried it to the area and dropped it off. That does happen with birds.
Well, isn't there a normal habitat near Area 51 somewhere down in Texas?
All right, Vicki in Brookfield, let us go to you. Hi, Vicki.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, we live in Brookfield and near the Fox River Conservancy, so we have a lot of wonderful bird activity in our backyard. Hummingbirds, red-bellied woodpeckers, orioles, the whole works. It's just absolutely wonderful, and we love watching. The other day, we had a male cardinal come to our feeder, and this guy did not have a single feather on his head.
Bald cardinal syndrome, yes.
It's what?
Well, I've heard this before. It doesn't have a name, but I'm calling it bald cardinal syndrome.
Oh, my goodness. I just felt so bad for him because I couldn't imagine what would happen. And he seems to, you know, he comes to the feeders and eats, and I just didn't know if we should keep him shaded or his poor little bare skull.
Some sunscreen.
Well, I doubt if it'll last. It's probably something to do with the molt or maybe perhaps disease, but the bird will probably get the feathers back. It could have been picked on by another bird. It could be a young bird. Maybe it's not growing out right. By the way, there was true baldness in birds is very rare. Here in the U.S., we have vultures or turkeys. Yeah. But there was a bald bird discovered in Asia just last week, the week before. It's a brand-new bird species. So the bald cardinal is not considered a separate species yet, but he'll grow it back.
All right. There you have it. Thanks a lot for calling, Vicki. And Sarah in Solon Springs. On to you now. Thank you for calling.
I just have a question about a whippoorwill. We've lived in the same house for 6 years, and every spring, about the end of May, a whippoorwill comes, and he stays until about mid-July. I haven't heard him for a while now, but he whippoorwills all night long, and he actually gets hoarse, I think, in the middle of the night because he starts making some awful sounds, and I'm wondering why he does that. And I don't hear anyone, another bird answering him. He just goes on and on all night long.
Well, he's probably still waiting for a mate, and Okay. I think maybe some birds just maybe get a thrill out of hearing their own voice. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why scientists think people, or I mean, birds sing, but my best guess is that it just likes to hear itself sing and that still waiting for that perfect mate.
Okay, all right.
You know, I want to add one thing to that.
Sure.
Birds will probably not wear out their voices. They have a lot of durability. There have been studies done where they'll count the number of songs, and a song sparrow will do 1,500 songs in a day, or they've measured, I think it was a Kirtland's warbler that in one day did 2,500 songs. And the world record for most songs in a day is 22,197 by the red-eyed vireo that was counted back in the 50s. So a whippoorwill can belt out a lot of songs before its voice gets tired.
Oh, man. And what does it have, a music box there, a voice box?
Actually, the whippoorwill does not. It has a primitive song box. And I'm going to take the time just to explain this quickly, Larry, if you don't mind.
Mm-hmm.
But it's fascinating to me. In the humans, we have at the top of our throat, a voice box, a larynx, all right? And
yep.
So that at the top of our windpipe, we have a sound-making device. Well, the bird has a larynx, and it also has what's called a syrinx, which is its song box. I'm going to call it that unscientifically. But the reason a bird can make noise is because, if you imagine an upside-down Y, right at the point where the bronchi, the two lungs, divide off from the windpipe,
mm-hmm.
there's this very, very complex device called a syrinx. And if you, let's compare this. Say you want to compare this to a wind instrument, and you took a reed, and you took a hollow reed, and you cut off both ends, and you blew through it, you'd get a sound pretty much just sound like this. You'd go, you know, there'd be no tune to it or anything. A lot of birds have a very primitive windpipe. If you took a white pelican or a vulture, they pretty much just have a windpipe without any kind of control over it, and so they make very little sound. The birds that make more sounds as they get more complicated have muscles attached to these syrinx, and some birds, if you have, say you take now that windpipe that's a reed, and you start to make holes in it, it becomes a recorder or a flute, and you can change the sounds. And what happens with birds is that they attach muscles, or there are muscles attached to the syringeal muscles, they're called, and they pluck at this membrane, and the bird can kind of do this without thinking. Inside its chest, it can pluck these membranes and make these complicated sounds. And so birds like a mockingbird, a nightingale that make very, very complicated sounds, have like up to 9 sets of muscles, 9 pairs of muscles, that, you know, one attached to each side of the syrinx. So a whippoorwill is a primitive bird. It does not have the 9 muscles, but it has enough muscles inside there to manipulate the sound that's coming through its voice. That's the long explanation.
That's very cool. You can join in with your questions here. We're talking about birds and bird music, songs and calls today with John Fife and Steve Bechtol. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Dave Potratz, our on-air producer today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Zeroing in a bit today on bird music, songs, and calls with John Fife and Steve Bechtol. Gail in Fort Atkinson up with a question or comment. Hi, Gail.
Hi. About 2 weeks ago at 2 o'clock at night, there was a horse in my front yard. Nay! I thought, my God, I live out in the country, and we're surrounded by farms, but I don't know anybody that has a horse. So I woke up my cousin, and he went outside because I knew there was a horse out there. Well, there was no horse. And I went on a, shortly after that, I went on a DNR hiking tour, and I asked the guide, what sounds like a horse? And he thought it was an owl. So I looked up in my owl book, and sure enough, the eastern screech owl sounds like a horse neighing, and it had a quote in there by Thoreau that he was thought that was so fascinating. My question is, was he just passing through, or has he been living on my farm for 40 years and I didn't know it?
Well, I don't know. What do you think, John?
Screech owls do sound like a horse. It's a whinny sound. Unfortunately, I don't have the sound right here. I'm sure Steve can imitate it. Hey, Steve?
Oh. I'm not good at screech owls.
It's a tough one.
Another one.
Ooh, something like that. And yeah, they do live in city parks. I mean, more commonly in bigger woods. But I wouldn't be surprised if you've always had a screech owl. And sometimes their voice is a little quiet. So unless it's nearby, you wouldn't be able to hear it.
Mm-hmm.
Gail, while you're on the phone, we're going to teach you a mnemonic. We're going to teach you a bird. We're going to teach you another owl. John, do you have a saw-whet owl by any chance?
Not in the CD that I brought.
Gail, can you whistle?
Yeah.
All right. To imitate a saw-whet owl, this is a little easier to do. All you have to do is whistle. Just go.
Well, I guess I can't. You know what? I am signed up with my granddaughter to go up in Stevens Point on the 18th, I think it is, of October, and help catch and tag those saw-whet.
Yeah.
Oh, well, excellent.
You'll get good practice at imitating them, man. Just remember, whistle. Just like that. That's what they sound like.
And it just goes on and on for hours sometimes.
That's an easy one to imitate.
We've got I've got another one up here. Let me play. Should we play?
Sure.
Let's play one here. Okay.
This is a song of the hermit thrush again, and when Steve started talking about the technicalities of how birds make sound, I wanted to add about how he was talking about how the branches go into each lung. Well, because of that, it means that birds basically have two reed instruments that they can play at the same time. So this bird actually is playing what they describe as a spiraling song, where one part of the song is going up and the other one is going down. And if you can play the next track, I slowed it down so you can actually hear the two different flutes at the same time.
That is too cool.
That is really cool,
and,
isn't it?
The hermit thrush is actually the favorite song of a lot of people, especially... Because I think, I mean, not only is it very ethereal and hard to find, it never sings during migration, but when you actually find one, it's usually in some very pristine, large forest. And I brought a quote just to kind of give people the general idea of how inspiring this song has been for ages. This is from 1871, and it's I'll read just a little bit of it. It's John Burroughs, a very famous naturalist writer who inspired a lot of people like Walt Whitman. Here goes. It's if you want to play track one while I'm singing this, maybe it'll go with it. Here we go.
The first track.
The
of
first
the bird?
Track. Yeah, the hermit thrush in the background, mounting towards the upland again. I pause reverently as the hush and stillness of twilight come upon the woods. It is the sweetest, ripest hour of the day, and as the hermit's evening hymn goes up from the deep solitude below me, I experience that serene exaltation of sentiment of which music, literature, and religion are but the faint types and symbols.
Whoa!
So it's kind of like the most grandiose bird song, I think, in terms of inspiring poets. And even the Native Americans, the Iroquois, said that this bird was the one who went up to the skies and brought down the sounds of spirits. So bird songs can be both very uplifting and almost religious experiences. And then I think Steve and I wanted to do some kind of more funny bird song mnemonics later on in the show. So we'll cover all bases.
We'll get all the bases covered here. Well, Gail, thanks again for calling. Appreciate it. Tom and Stoddard, turn to you next. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. Yes, I want to talk about a bald cardinal. About 35 years ago, I was walking along the road by my folks' house, and I found, it was in fall, and I found this scalped cardinal. He had had a collision with an automobile, and I picked him up, and he bit into the webbing of my hand between my thumb and my fingers, and it was extremely painful, but I just let him go. I figured he's got more pain than me. But I took him home and put him in a 5-quart ice cream bucket, and it was fortunate that he was in such a small confined area that he wasn't jumping around and hurting himself further. But then later I built a cage for him that gave him more room with a branch in it, and he lived in that. We had ground corn and different food to give to him, but I didn't at all think about giving him grit. And in spring, in March, I let him out, and he hopped along the sidewalk to the gravel in the driveway, and he picked up some gravel real quick, and then he disappeared. But he had his scalp had healed over, and he had feathers over it, but he never did have his top knot after that.
Yeah.
And he must have had a really strong hankering for grit.
he must have. Well, interesting story. Comment, Steve?
Well, it sounds like you are a very good bird rehabilitator, and you learned one of the first lessons of bird banding is don't let those big-billed grosbeak family birds get a hold of the webbing between thumb and forefinger.
Thanks, Tom, for calling. Let's go to Jan in Wanakee. Hello, Jan. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
My folks live near Arlington, and they're really near Goose Pond. Mm-hmm. And there's a small pond across 51, and I've been noticing what I believe are two whooping cranes, and I can't hear them call or anything, but when they stand next to the sandhill cranes, they're obviously much bigger.
Yeah.
And they do get after them once in a while.
Are they white?
They're very white.
Yeah.
And I have tried to call and email the International Crane Foundation,
uh-huh,
but I haven't heard anything from them yet, and I just wondered, do they think I'm crazy, or...
No. There is a lot of dispersal of the birds, and they show up all over the place. There was a young bird, I think it was a female, in Chippewa County up here for a couple of years, and so they are showing up all over the place. They wander out of Nisida, and you will see and hear reports of them all over the place, mixing with sandhills, just as you saw them. And that is probably the case. You are seeing whooping cranes.
They probably already know that there's one around, so they didn't bother to answer back. But yeah, it's good when you see a rare bird like that to try to report it to somebody, because there's always somebody who's very curious about it.
What's the hooper sound like?
I actually don't have a recording of that, but maybe Steve can imitate it.
Yeah, that one I can't do either. It's a very loud, I can do a sandhill crane. That one goes, kakurr.
Mm-hmm.
And the trumpeting of the whooping crane is a lot more broadcast and deeper and more resonant and harder for the human voice to do. Some things you just can't handle with the human voice.
All right. Thanks, Jan. Appreciate the call. Joe in Centuria, we'll go to you next. Hi, Joe.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm going to use the process of elimination to try and figure out what I'm hearing is a bird call or other sort of animal call. And I'll try and imitate it as best I can.
Okay.
It's just a single sound note. I hear it we kind of live in some wooded area. I've heard it where we live up in northwestern Wisconsin. I've also heard it at my son's place over in East Lansing, Michigan. But it's also where there's a lot of trees. And the sound is just a single note. It's like that out in the woods.
Oh.
Am I listening to a bird, or am I listening to an animal?
It's a tapping sound?
Yeah, just like a single, like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not like it's tapping against wood or like a wood.
You know what a chipmunk sounds like?
I've heard chipmunks, and I didn't know if that's what they were doing. If that's,
A chipmunk makes like a clucking note. It's a very thick cluck. And you can hear those out in the woods. But that does not sound to me like a bird.
Mm-mm.
That I know of. And so I would wonder if maybe it's a chipmunk, but it's hard to tell.
Okay. All right. But well, I guess
you're very brave to demonstrate on public radio, and I applaud you for that.
Well, what the heck,
Yeah, why not, Joe? Sometimes. Thanks for doing that.
All right, thanks a lot.
You bet. Take care. Adam in Gleason, on to you now. Hi, Adam.
Hello. About a week ago, I saw in a field full of sandhill cranes, there was a white crane. I don't know if it was a whooping crane or if it was a albino sandhill.
No, where do you live?
Up in Gleason.
That's pretty
Gleason, fine. Wisconsin. It's, do you know where Merrill is?
Yeah.
North of Merrill, about half an hour.
Well, there is, we were just saying this, there is some wandering. The young birds, especially the females, the males are more faithful to where they are raised, and so the females tend to wander out. And when they bond with a male, then they tend to move back to where the male calls home. So it could be a female out wandering somewhere. Now, the Crane Foundation and the crane people are kind of sensitive about publicly telling people where the cranes are because they don't want a lot of trouble, they don't want too much attention. And so they tend to kind of put a lid on sightings so that it's not all that public. But people are seeing them all over the place, and they get very excited when they see them. So,
all right. Okay.
Be the case.
All right.
Is there a chance that it's just an albino sandhill?
I haven't ever seen one myself. How about you, John?
No, I never have, but there is a chance always.
Okay. All right, thank you.
All right, thanks for calling.
Joe or Adam, you should probably make sure when the bird flies, an albino would not have the black in the wingtips.
Yeah.
The whooping crane has the black in the wingtips, and so you can tell that when it flies.
All right. On to Jerry in Hudson. Hi, Jerry.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi. We're about 4 miles out of Hudson, and we live in a wooded rural development development out here. So we've had a feeding station ever since we moved here about 11 years ago. And last year my husband said he spotted an indigo bunting, and I thought he was joking. And I caught a glimpse of it, but I keep a little kind of haphazard journal. And on May 9th, we had an indigo bunting. In fact, I think a pair show up at our feeder. And we have bluebirds nesting here, so we know what those look like.
Mm-hmm.
And we checked it in a bird book, and it was an indigo bunting, and it stayed around for a few weeks. So they're in our area. I know you're talking about they're rare up here,
yeah.
But we've had them now for 2 years, and they're kind of fleeting. It's not been here since May this year.
Well, I bet that you have indigo buntings nesting all over the place around you, but to see it is one thing, to hear it is another. They're a very, very bold singer. And so John and I are going to teach you the mnemonic for the indigo bunting right now. We each have a different one. Mine is, see, see, the pretty, pretty bird, bird, see it. It has this coupled phrasing, and it's a very loud and distinctive song. John, what's your mnemonic for you?
Mine is, fire, fire, where, here, here, there, there. So it's very repetitive. If you hear something that sounds like a goldfinch, and it's the goldfinch tone is really hard to describe, but you just have to get it in your head by seeing a lot of goldfinches. If you think, oh, that sounds like a goldfinch, but it's repeating itself again over and over, then you should definitely spend some time, pick up your binoculars, and look at the very tops of trees. It's usually it might not look very bright blue if it's at the very top of a tree, but get your binoculars on it and wait till it comes down a little bit, and then you'll see the sun refract and see the bright blue. I think we have a recording of that somewhere. Let's see.
We do?
I'm
just trying to find it. I'm not seeing it.
We'll play it later.
The birds they also sing on power lines. But if you really want to learn the bird songs, it's a good way to do it. Pick up John's CD or his DVD. It's an excellent resource for learning bird songs, and it helps you to distinguish by sound what you can't always see.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And you might, as long as we're talking about your CD and your DVD, John, explain how that's set up. It's kind of a cool way that you have it set up.
Well, the CD was actually at first made for myself so that I could remember bird songs. Every year you kind of forget, and it's like learning a new language that you don't use. And so I made the CD that I could quiz myself. I would play the bird. I played the bird song of birds that I recorded in Wisconsin, and then I have the mnemonic. So, for example, the indigo bunting, the fire, fire, where, here, here. The mnemonic always encodes some bit of information about the song. The fire, fire, where, kind of shows you that it's very rhythmic and repetitive. Some of the other mnemonics, like who cooks for you, make you sing with a low pitch, so you sound like an owl, of the barred owl, and some of the other mnemonics like cheeseburger. The E sounds always make you talk naturally higher pitch, like pee-wee. And so all these mnemonics are placed after the song, and then if you still can't guess, then it tells you what the bird song is. So after you've listened to the CD, I don't know, 10, 20 times, you usually know at least 10, 20 bird songs.
Very good. And the DVD is quite different. It's
The DVD is kind of also for learning bird songs, but you get to actually see the pictures on your television or in your computer. It helps for people who are more visually centered to actually have a visual of the bird. I myself don't mind just putting the CD in my car and listening to it over and over in February or March so that I'm ready to from doing surveys.
And, Steve, as long as we're talking about different things, your book, All This and Robins Too, A Guide to the 50 or So Best Places to Find Birds in Wisconsin, that sold like hotcakes there too, didn't it?
Yes, it's doing very well. And I have a new project in the works. Along with Rooney Printing in Chippewa Falls, we are developing regional guides And they're true pocket guides. You can insert them into your bird guide, and it's real handy to carry. They're kind of short books, real small books. And we're doing regional guides. One of the first ones is coming out, all of this, and Titmice, too, which is a pocket guide to the bird finding in the Chippewa Valley. And we're doing one for bird feeding, too. So all of these will be coming out shortly, and we're hoping to disperse them.
Let's go to Tom in Madison next. Tom, hi to you.
I'm fine. How are you, gentlemen, this morning?
What? Just great.
Good, good. I have a comment and a question. Comment is about the clicking sound that was being discussed about 5 minutes ago.
Yeah.
I heard that for several years, and it was driving me crazy, too. And I finally found out that it's not a bird. It's a 13-line ground squirrel.
Ground squirrel.
I actually saw the thing. I was looking right at it, and it was making this kind of a
click.
Clicking, wood-pounding type of of sound. I never would have suspected that. So that's my best guess on that. My question is about a bird call that I heard last half of June, first half of July. I've been through several CDs online, et cetera. I can't figure out what it is. I have a crude recording of it, and your screener said just play it and see.
Yeah, go ahead.
So I'm going to put it up here for about maximum 15 seconds, okay?
Okay.
So here we go. How's that?
Okay, well,
anything off of that?
I'm going to give Steve a shot because I can not barely hear that.
Yeah, well, what it sounds like to me is it sounds like the song of a robin or one of that type of the undulating flute-like notes is what I heard, but I could hear was something that sounded like a robin.
Is it during the day that it sings?
It is. It is not a robin. It's like a tweet-tweet, tew-tew. Sound, and it's I'm pretty familiar with all the robin.
A tweet, tweet, chew, chew, is that you said?
Yeah, it's kind of a tweet, a high-pitched tweet, 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 and then there's a descending chew, chew, and it's not a cardinal.
Hmm. Yeah, because that's what it sounds like. That sounds like a cardinal, too.
No.
Yeah.
Hmm. Yellow-throated warbler would be rare, but you would have to live in southwest Wisconsin. I can't think of anything else because cardinal was the first thing that came to mind when you described a tweet.
How is your recording? What have you recorded that on?
Just a small hand recorder.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you don't have it in a WAV file or anything like that. You could send an email.
Mm-hmm.
No, I could maybe call one of you and play it again. So it.
Well, if you burned a, can you burn a disc maybe, a CD of it?
Yeah, I could burn a disc probably.
Yeah, maybe if you mailed it to one of us, and it might be a lot clearer. It really, through the phone, it was very difficult to hear.
I expected that, yes. Well, if you could give me an address.
Sure. Yeah, gonebirding88@hotmail.com is my address. And,
mine's Feith, F-E-I-T-H, @charter.net.
All right.
I just got, my son took a job in Alaska, and so I told him all about the birds that he was seeing there, and he sent me back three samples of songs just this week, and so I was real excited to get to him, and before I read his notes, I started listening to him, and one of them was he said he was up in the mountains, and it's great fun to play bird detective with song, but the first one, he said he's up in the mountains, and so my computer is starting to key into the habitat, and he plays it, and I'm hearing this jip-ip, jip-ip, or tit-it, jit-it, jit-it. And it's the American pipit, and I got that one pretty quick. And then he played another one, and it was this tsi-tsi-day-day of the boreal chickadee. And I got that one because Alaska's only chickadee is pretty common.
Check the day-day-day.
Yeah, check the day-day, or yesterday-day. And then he played a third one. He has a third one on there, and I'm listening to it, and I'm thinking, all right, wait a minute, that's a yellow throat. And the second one sounds like a summer tanager. And I'm looking at my range, and I'm thinking, what on earth sounds like a summer tanager in Alaska? And then I read the bottom of the note. He said, oh, this one was when I was in Florida. And so sometimes it helps to have a habitat cue or some other kind of cue, but you don't always get it even when you're familiar. But, you know, you have to have some point of reference.
Oh. Tom, thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Jerry in Spring Green, your turn. Hi, Jerry.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a cottage right on the river and have been spending summers here for years. And I don't hear the Bob Whites anymore. I don't hear whippoorwills anymore. And I don't hear the catbird. And sometimes I throw some bread out for the crows, and I used to get 15, 20 crows coming. Now it's like 4 or 5. And I'm just wondering, is there a decline in these birds?
Yeah, you've got probably some mixed problems. Now, a while ago, West Nile virus was picking off crows, and I don't know if there have been any studies done saying that, you know, the crow population is down. Up here in Eau Claire, I don't see any difference in the crow population. But I know that there was a big die-off of crows, corvids, blue jays, when West Nile virus hit a few years ago. And maybe down by you, they were more affected. Things like the Bob White, that's another problem. A Bob White is a southern species, usually in the southeastern United States. And if there's a harsh winter, which we have not had in a couple of winters, that can kill off the Bob White population. They don't do well in heavy snow cover. And things like a whippoorwill, that's suffering because people are clearing forests. There's not as much habitat. So they all have a little different issue going on there. And there are other things going on. Global warming, which I believe in. I am an advocate that we as humans are responsible for that, is affecting range. There have been studies done that birds are creeping north and that the range is changing. And so there are a lot of factors that determine which birds are there and aren't there.
Thanks very much. And John, you were going to add something?
Yeah, I was going to add about Bob Whites. The numbers always go up and down quite drastically. It seems like from year to year, at least when I do a bird survey out in southwest Wisconsin, there'll be days when 3 hours go by and I don't hear a single Bob White. And then the next year I'll hear 25. And then the next year, several years go by and I don't hear a single one. So you can't really say statistically that it's significant over, you know, several years. But if you haven't seen a Bob White in, say, 10 years, then maybe I would just wonder if some of your neighbors have cleared some areas, or maybe some of your neighbors are feeding better. Maybe there's a bird feeder a mile away from your house. Maybe that's where all the crows are going, or maybe there used to be some trees, rows that were cut down where the bobwhites used to hang out between the fields for cover, and they're not there anymore. So there's a lot of variables, and that's one of the reasons why it's important to keep count of birds in general over many years, so that we can make some actual scientific observations.
And thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Talking birds today, bird music, songs, and calls with John Fyth of Madison, producer of the CD Bird Song Ear Training Guide, Who Cooks for Poor Sam Peabody? Also the DVD Birds, 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 an indoor bird watching field trip. Steve Betchkal of Eau Claire has been chasing birds for 40 years, the author of All of This and Robins Too, a guide to the 50 or so best places to find birds in Wisconsin. Questions for these guys? Zeroing in a bit on the songs and calls today, give us a ring of your own or call of your own at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking birds today, bird music, songs and calls with John Fyth and Steve Betchkal. Really happy to have you listening in. Give us a call. Send us an email if you have a question. And you mentioned indigo bunting.
Mm-hmm. We couldn't find the track before, and people are always wondering, well, I see an indigo bunting, and then I stop seeing it for a while, and I feel like it left my woods. Well, it's probably just not as visible because it's maybe deeper in the woods taking care of its nest. But then the male will still fly high up and sing, and if you don't know the call, you'll probably missing it, and it could be singing right above you. It's one of the best bird songs to learn, because once you learn an indigo bunting, you can be walking out in the field and impress a lot of people by just pointing and saying, there's an indigo bunting, and all of a sudden this blue gem appears out of nowhere.
Well, let's listen to an indigo bunting.
So there you can see hear the repetition, fire, fire, where, here, there, there.
There you have it.
There's a relative of the indigo bunting down south called the painted bunting. And people up here say, oh, the indigo bunting is a beautiful bird, and it is. But if you've ever seen the painted bunting, you can't imagine a bird more colorful. It has a red head, purple back. I mean, it has a blue head, a red on the body, green, emerald green below.
Oh.
So it's one of these most beautiful birds, but it's really kind of hard to see in the brush. And I was down south, and I was standing listening to another bird when my mental computer went off, and the mnemonic I use, and I'm very mnemonical. I use that adjective. John and I are both very mnemonical. We use mnemonics to, people say, oh, how do you know all these birds, and how can you listen and hear that bird? Well, I have used these tricks over the years to recognize birds, and I heard the mnemonic device go off in my head. It is, do you perceive the need for sweet destiny? That is the mnemonic that I use for a painted bunting. And I heard this, and my mind said, wait a minute, what is that song over there? Do you perceive the need for sweet destiny? And so I went over to where the bird was singing, and there it was. And I got this eye-level look at this one of the most beautiful songbirds in North America. But without that trigger, that mnemonic trigger, I would not have even realized the bird was present because it was a background noise, and I would have ignored it or passed it by.
Oh. I'm always very impressed with Steve because he makes up a lot of very crazy mnemonics that nobody has ever heard before. Steve, if you want to share some of your crazy mnemonics.
You know, I say this all the time, and people will say, you know, oh, that doesn't sound like that. You know, but the point is, to me, it makes sense. Like, I figured out if you can take a simple bird like a chickadee, like your cheeseburger, you know, the simple octave note of this chickadee can be imitated. But if you take a complicated song, those are the ones that are really hard, like the indigo bunting. But I took a bird, for example, that I thought was really hard, a ruby-crowned kinglet, and I said, I need to make a mnemonic device for this song. And do you have that recording, John? Of
I believe so. Let's see, number 22.
22. We'll look. Hold on a second. We'll just have to back it up here. There we go. Let's play that and listen.
Oh, it started.
Oh, let me start that over again. That was 22. We'll start it over again. Oh, there we go.
It's a very complicated song. It's a matter of starting out with some whistles, and then it kind of picks up speed and has this very rapid rolling ending. And if you use the mnemonic, D-D-D, chatter-chatter, chatter, deer, 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 double-D, 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 that pretty much illustrates what the bird is singing. So if you can memorize that, you have the song nailed, and once you hear it, there is no mistaking it. And there are a couple that are really fun.
Well, do that one again, and then I'm going to play that again.
Okay. D-D-D, chatter-chatter, chatter, deer, double-D, 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 double-D.
All right.
And it's a little tough to hear that, but if you're in the field and you can master that mnemonic, you will get the bird. There's another one. A favorite of mine is a western kingbird, and we don't have them in Wisconsin, but they say, twick, twick, or tweet, tweet, tweety bird. Twick, twick, or tweet, tweet, tweety bird. And if you hear that, you never will confuse a western kingbird again because you will have that mnemonic down.
Actually, one of my favorites of yours is the house finch, which I think is, I don't know if it's in the CD, I think it made it to the DVD, and I have a track for that too. Let's see if I can find that house finch number 26. And Steve, you better do the mnemonic. Which is the year of the rich witchity witch year?
Yeah, if you listen to a house finch, it has a lot of itch sounds in it and ear sounds in it, itch ear. So, which is the year of the rich witch right ear? Which is the year of the rich witch right ear?
Let me say it slowly so people know what Steve came up with. Which is the year of the rich witchita itchy ear?
Well, let's listen to it.
Now, you have to use some imagination, obviously.
That one was a little longer than usual, so it didn't quite fit. But the ear part at the end is a very common part of the house finch. So a lot of these mnemonics, there's only two or three bits of information, like the witch starts off kind of hard and then and ends with the ear. And in between, you just really have to use your imagination. And you'd be surprised at first, even the worst, like the song sparrow, it goes, maids, 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 put on your tea kettle, let a little. First time I went on a bird trip, the leader sang that, and I just thought, wow, this lady is crazy. But after hearing about 15 different song sparrows, you can get it in your head that on average, yeah, song sparrows kind of do. Maids, 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 put on your tea kettle, little, little, little. And none of them actually sing that particular song. Maybe there was one that somebody heard that did that exact reproduction of that. But in general, the song sparrow will have three introductory notes and then a different part, and then at the end it kind of does a rattly kind of la 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 la. So there's a lot of information on these mnemonics, and that mnemonic could be hundreds of years old, because before CDs were around, that was the way to learn birdsong.
My mnemonic for the Song Sparrow is chip chippy, keep up the clinking of the killy clee, so peace do. And so if you really are paying attention to a Song Sparrow, now this is an interesting one because that has a dialect. That is one of the classic examples. If you go around the United States, Song Sparrows have not only dialects, but they have song types and song phrases. And so a Song Sparrow might sing a variety of phrases. They won't repeat the same phrase over and over again. So if you say to yourself, well, I'm going to listen for that one certain phrase, you will always fail. But you have to start recognizing a pattern of the way the song sings. It's the way the bird sings its song. Is it buzzy? Is it fast? Is there a jumble of notes? Is there a whistled introduction? And that bird, a song sparrow, is one of the most diverse and most well-studied songs in the U.S. because of its dialects.
And then actually the white-crowned sparrow, which I have a recording of 23, if you can play that, that is has a dialect that changes throughout the states very drastically. And there's places in northern California where you can walk a mile and have completely different songs. The song I have recorded is the one that you hear mostly in Wisconsin. And it's one of my favorite mnemonics I made up myself. And it goes, more cheese, cheese, please, please. Can you play 23?
Sure, let's do that one. Ah, oh, for crying out loud. Hold on a second here.
Just try to imagine more cheese, cheese, please, please. More cheese, cheese, please, please. And it doesn't nest around in southern Wisconsin. I think it not even in northern Wisconsin. It's hard to find. But I kind of like adding bits of cheese and beer to any mnemonic I come up with, especially the ones for Wisconsin bird songs.
Well, that was pretty close. I you really could catch that.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. That bird species, the white-crowned sparrow, there have been studies done that introductory whistle of that bird's song is how the birds distinguish that it's their song. If they don't have that introductory whistle, they don't recognize it as their song. And so birds, the way they learn songs and the way they apply their songs to one another is a very complicated science and learning pattern. So that's an interesting word. By the way, John, I have two questions for you that have gone unanswered, and I need satisfaction. First of all, who does cook for Sam Peabody? And why are so many mnemonics named after beer and sweets?
Well, I'm not. It's not clear to me who cooks for poor Sam Peabody. But I think the reason why a lot of the mnemonics are you know, and I didn't make up most of the mnemonics that have beer-related themes, like quick three beers or my favorite free beer. And all the cheese ones, they're not Wisconsin mnemonics. I mean, I tried to make them more Wisconsin, but they've been around for many years. And I think that if you're going to try to come up with something that is memorable, well, why not come up with something like sweets, candy, sweet, 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 little more sweet, or beer, or, I mean, there's even mnemonics that involve tobacco and just cheery things like the cardinal. What cheer, cheer, cheer. So these are the things that stick with you, things that are very happy and festive, I guess.
Well, Brian in La Crosse has a comment or question. Brian, thanks for waiting. Hello.
Yeah, real quick. I mean, mine doesn't have to do with calls or songs. It's basically I have this large bird when I was about 12 years old, about 32 years ago, that it dive bombs you, and it makes a sound with the wings. It's more of a and takes off flying. My dad told me it was a nighthawk.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I have not seen any nighthawks in, well, I guess it'd be southwest Wisconsin since.
Are you live in La Crosse?
Yeah.
La Crosse is traditionally a great spot for nighthawks going over the city. And if they're declining, I know here in Eau Claire they have declined, and there has been a drastic drop-off of nighthawks, I think, in Wisconsin. They're not a bird that's doing well, but that's what you're talking about. They call them bull bats because they make like a roaring sound as they dive with their wings. By the way, that is called sonation, and birds sonate. They make different sounds with body parts, their wings, a rough grouse drumming its wings, or with their feet.
Or the
and that is not a song or call, but it's sonation.
And
okay.
One of the reasons for the nighthawk decline is there used to be a lot more gravel that builders would put on top of buildings, and a lot of nighthawks would nest on gravel downtown, and now it's harder to find those gravelly roofs.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for calling, Brian. And Dave in Augusta, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hello. Real quick, I've only heard this bird twice. Once was in Big Spring, Wisconsin, small little town outside of Wisconsin Dells, and then the other one has been recently outside of my farm in Augusta, and it sounds like one of the Three Stooges. It goes, and it makes a diving. It dives right toward dusk. It dives down.
You have a marsh near you?
Bird. Pardon me?
You have a marsh or wetlands near you?
Yes, we do.
That's a sora rail.
It
Winnie
is.
Winnie is a sora rail.
I actually have that.
That's somewhere. It. Yes, that's it.
We have
it's
we
a
have...
little tiny rail called a sora.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. That's cool.
We stay listening because...
Number 46.
46 here. Let's see if we can get that up quick before we take our break. All right, now this time I'm going to try. Here we go.
That's it.
All right. Glad we could solve that for you. Yeah. Hey, if you want a great party trick, take somebody out to that wetlands when it's quiet and start clapping your hands really loudly because a sora rail will respond to a sharp noise with that whinny.
Oh, cool idea. Tell you what, we've got lots more to come with our two guests, John Fyth and Steve Bechtol, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking birds today on the Ideas Network, bird music, the songs and the calls of birds, John Fyth and Steve Bechtol, our guests today. It's always great to have them come by and talk with us. And they'll be here right up until 12:30 today. So time for you to call in with your question at 800-642-1234 or email at talk@wpr.org. And a few minutes ago, I played a song. Let me play that again. Or should we? Let's just play it again. Okay, and what do we have there?
Well, that's the song kind of opposite of the hermit thrush, where the hermit thrush is maybe the prettiest and most ethereal. This one people think of as like kind of the ugliest, kind of a nasty song. And even the mnemonic is kind of nasty. It goes, "Don't you dare!" And it's the yellow-headed blackbird. I saw one just last week at Goose Pond. They're more of a western bird, so they're not easy to find. But they're kind of, you know, they're in the same red-winged blackbird family, but just a brilliant yellow head. And if you find one, you're lucky in Wisconsin. And I'm sure Steve can do it much better than I can.
You know, we were talking about, this is, by agreement, one of the ugliest songs of any North American songbird. And that Don't You Dare is a great mnemonic, but you really got to give it more. You got to imagine that you're projecting your guts out of your throat when you sing it. And it makes the worst noise you can possibly imagine like that is a yellow-headed blackbird. And you're not far off from how they really sound in the wild.
Oh, man. Well, Lori in Oconomowoc has a comment or question. Let's go to Lori. Hi, Lori.
Hi. I have a comment, and it's not song-related either. Sorry.
That's all right.
Okay. Blue-gray gnatcatchers, which do make kind of cool little sounds.
Mm-hmm.
They were lying flat on their stomachs on top of our garage roof in the sun.
Uh-huh.
You're laughing, and they really were. I thought they were leaves lying up there. Their wings are all spread out, their tails all spread out behind them, and they'll lay there real flat for a minute, and then they'll fly up in the tree, and then somebody else will come down and do the same thing.
Well, they were sunbathing, I would guess.
But it was hot. Were they getting cooked?
Birds have several mechanisms for fighting their ectoparasites, the parasites on the outside of their body, and birds have a lot of problems with feather lice. And So one of the ways they do that is through sunbathing. If they expose their feathers to heat, the insects, I'm sorry, they're not insects at all, the arachnids, I believe, would be appropriate. The lice would hide under the feathers. They don't like exposure to the sun. They do dust baths. That supposedly helps as well as bathing, and they preen their feathers to keep those ectoparasites down. And I'm going to guess that that's what they were doing. They were sunbathing to try to knock down those ectoparasites.
I'm sure that warm roof felt pretty nice that gnatcatcher.
Yeah, absolutely. There you have it, Lori.
Well, thank you.
By the way, they did a study once. I think it was on a domestic pigeon, and they found like 65 65 different ectoparasites on the bird, or in the bird, or on the bird, maybe both in and outside the bird. They found 65 different kinds of organisms living on that pigeon. So you probably don't want to handle one.
Wow. What about, well, here's an email from, let's see, who's this from? From Christine, and she wonders how many different calls orioles have. I know two different ones. I was wondering if there's any more.
Well, orioles are actually... One of the songs where mnemonics doesn't really help, I do have one mnemonic for one recording that I have in the CD. It goes something like, "Here, here, come right here, dear." But it almost never works. An oriole is one of those songs that to identify it, you just hear this perfect flute. To me, it doesn't get any better in terms of the tone. And I wouldn't be surprised if each oriole can sing 20 different songs, and then you go from. As you move around the state, I would say that the number of oriole songs is countless. This year, there was, in the place I go bird watching a lot, in Pheasant Branch, there was an oriole that just was making the strangest sounds, and it was just making everybody just go crazy. Because if it wasn't because of the tone of the voice, you'd totally be confused with that oriole song.
Well, let's hear one oriole song that you recorded. Mm-hmm.
That was that. Come right here, here. Mm-hmm. And for that one, it fits, but I've heard plenty of orioles where it doesn't really fit that well.
I've got the Sibley guide open, and his mnemonic is Pidoo Tootie Tootie Utie Toot to Do.
That's a perfect example of a useless mnemonic.
But they do have it also says here he has a whistled, Huli, Huli, and they do that two-note whistle, and you hear that a lot. They fragment their songs, is one of the problems. You don't always hear that full song that John just played. You hear fragmentary notes.
Claudia emailed and would love to hear you do a bluebird. I've tried to explain it to people and can't get it right. Also, I watched a bluebird all summer taking care of her eggs and young birds. When they fled, she made a different sound, sort of a sound deep in her throat. Or is this my imagination?
Well, you see, what she's talking about here is the difference between songs and calls. And a bird will have song types, and then it'll have its calls. And so a female near the nest site would have a variety of calls, maybe a locator or contact note. Or there are even people that say they have, like, contentment notes. But there's, you know, an alarm note, a threat note. And so these kinds of sounds that they might make with the young might be a signal, you know, come closer to me, you're getting too far away. Or it might be, here I am with the food, you know. But the note itself is described, and the classic is cheer, chuffle, cheer, chuffle, charma, cheer, chuffle, charma. And so they have a sound like that, but they also have like a sharp note, like a jew, jew, as they fly over. It's a very high bell-like note. John,
I have a recording here. Maybe we should just play it. But the cheer, cheerful charmer, I think, is a really good mnemonic for its song. I was going to play the other part, I think. Yeah, that's the other. It's a really warbly.
Chew.
Well, let's go back and just, we can do it again.
Who doesn't like bluebirds?
A second here.
Well, they're so darn cute. That's one of the things everybody loves about bluebirds, are cute.
49, right?
Yep.
I got the right one here.
That's often a flight note.
Fast.
You hear that one as in a flight note when they're flying overhead. You hear that a lot.
All right. Well, let's see. What else did she have to say? She saw 50 huge birds gliding. This is in I live in Afton. 50 huge birds gliding very, very high. They were right in the sun, so it was hard to look at them. Could they be pelicans or cranes?
Most definitely pelicans. Pelicans have become very common in Wisconsin. I remember 10 years ago, when I couldn't find a pelican unless I went out to the Mississippi. Maybe 15 years ago, and now you can see them in many large marshes like Horicon or Green Bay. And when they soar like that, they usually have a very straight V formation, and it's called a squadron of pelicans. And it's a pretty amazing sight because pelicans are a lot bigger than you think they are. They're huge.
Well, we were at Hilton Head a couple of weeks ago, and we saw several squadrons of pelicans over the course of a few days there. They're fun to watch, for sure. Barb in Grafton, we'll go to you. Hi, Barbara.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to comment on the buntings, on the indigo buntings.
Yeah.
We must be very, very lucky because we've had five or six pairs that come every spring and stay for at least a couple weeks, if not more, mm-hmm. 4 or 5 weeks.
Yeah. Yeah, they're not an uncommon bird. It's just that they're not one of the most common birds that show up at feeders. And so if you're not observant, if you're not paying attention to the periphery of your yard or seeking them out on the edge of a woods, you may not see them as much.
They hang out at our feeder all day long.
Ah, there you go. That's a great way to see
them. They eat at the feeder. They eat below the feeder. They walk around.
Oh, you're lucky.
I know. And they're just so beautiful.
At some point in summer, like I would say now, there's just so the food is so abundant. There's so many flowers and plants that are seeding that maybe some of these buntings don't need to go to the feeder as much, and maybe that's why you're not seeing them right in your feeder. But they could be still singing right on the trees right in front of you. But
and I will be sure to keep a better eye.
Well, keeping a good ear for them is actually
the much
easier way to spot them.
Yeah.
The only other bird that I've missed this year is the rufous-sided towhee. Hmm. We've always seen him every year with the buntings and the grosbeaks and the orioles, but I've yet to see one rufous-sided towhee.
Yeah. Can you do the mnemonic for that one, Barb?
Me?
You know it? Drink your tea.
She already did the one mnemonic, towhee.
Yeah.
And then the towhee has another song. The towhee is called "Drink Your Tea" is the song, and it's one of those food mnemonics like drinking tea. Tea is one of the other things that bird watchers apparently like.
Right. I choose just to watch, not to try to imitate.
We have number 12. We have it on.
Oh, we have.
We can play a towhee really quick. And actually, I made a track with a towhee from Wisconsin versus a towhee from Florida and one in San Diego, just to show how hugely variable that dialect of the towhee is.
All right, let's listen.
Yes, drink your tea. Drink your tea. Towhee, that's all Wisconsin. Oh, that's Florida. Florida again. And that's from San Diego, I think, or somewhere out west. So you can see that the eastern towhee mnemonic of towhee and drink your tea work really well east of the Mississippi. Once you get, too far south, then it becomes completely useless. And that's why it's good to have a CD of birds that is actually made for your state or for your area.
Very,
very good at that.
All right. Thanks very much for calling, Barb. Appreciate your call. Max in Brookfield, we go to you. Hi, Max.
How are you doing?
Good.
Yeah, I work at Wild Birds Unlimited in Brookfield.
Uh-huh.
And I had a lady call me today. And she was complaining about how her house sparrow is chasing away all of her other birds, and asked me what we can do about it and different seeds and stuff. And I told her, well, there's not much. I mean, you can try to capture them and take them away or something. But and then she was trying to tell me, are house sparrows an invasive species?
Yeah.
You guys know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah. They are. They were introduced here in the 1800s, and they probably, I think, Washington or New York, that's where all the birds are introduced.
New York.
Yeah, and they spread from there, and they've been here, 150 years, I believe it is?
I think the story is somebody brought in a bunch of all the species mentioned in Shakespeare plays one year, and all of a sudden we have starlings and all these European birds, like the house sparrow. And I would say, just have more feeders, and maybe you can have so many feeders that they won't care that some of the feeders are taken over by house finches or house sparrows. And
I actually watched the orioles. The sparrows will come to grape jelly feeders too, but I've watched my orioles. They'll come in and kick the sparrows out. they don't have any trouble kicking the sparrows out and getting at the grape jelly themselves.
Conventional wisdom says that sparrows prefer millet, and if you offer millet, they are attracted to that and less attracted to, say, Niger or black sunflower than to millet. So that may be something to just cut the millet out of the diet.
The other option is just to try to enjoy house sparrows because they're still beautiful birds.
It is true. I mean, if you know anything about house sparrows, did you know that the size of the black bib tells you about the age and dominance of the male? The bigger the black bib, And they are a very adaptive species, that's for sure. And in fact, John is right. There was a society actually formed to introduce all the birds listed in Shakespeare to the United States. It was a group of people dedicated to that cause.
Well, Kristen, thanks very much, Max, for calling. Appreciate your call. And Chris in Green Bay, we're talking about sparrows. Here's a comment about a white-throated sparrow. Chris in Green Bay saw at his feeders the last couple of days a white-throated sparrow teaching and feeding a larger baby bird. How many birds in our state will lay their eggs in other birds' nests?
Well, that was probably a case of cowbird parasitism, and I don't know how many other birds. I've heard that the American cuckoos very rarely will do parasitize another nest, and it's a very common thing these days, especially because forests are fragmented. A lot of birds that are used to living in very deep forests now have to deal with people coming in and tearing down some of the forests and having houses, and all these openings and clearings make it easy for cowbirds to spot nests, so the cowbird will find a nest and lay its eggs. And I've heard stories of, not the cowbird, but in Europe, the cuckoo is a different species. And that cuckoo, the babies will actually imitate the baby begging calls of the other species and eventually get so large that they kick the other babies out of the nest. So it's kind of a shame. There's a lot of people I know who hate cowbirds, but cowbirds are native to the U.S. and Wisconsin, so you can't be too harsh on them, but they do have an advantage now that we're making forests smaller.
There are two other cowbird species invading, the bronzed and the shiny, and those are in the southern part of the U.S., and those are hurting some species down south. There are some birds that have built-in mechanisms, like yellow warbler. If it finds a cowbird egg in its nest, it'll build another nest on top of that, seal it over with another nest. And there are some birds that have a mechanism like that. And brood parasitism, which is a type of parasitism in birds, is common to some duck species. Redheads, I think, do it. But one of the most interesting examples of that is hooded mergansers and wood ducks have this like vying competition to fly into the nest hole of the opposite species and lay an egg or two in there and get out and deposit their eggs into the clutch of the wood duck or the hooded merganser. And so you'll see a wood duck raise a nest of, say, 14 wood ducks and one hooded merganser in them. And so ducks do this, too. And so a lot of birds in that family will do that, but the American cuckoos don't typically lay their eggs in other birds' nests.
Megan emailed us, "I've heard but never seen a bird, I'm assuming it's a bird, that makes a call like one of those plastic flute-like things from grade school. When you blow into it, you blow down on the bottom, and it makes a trilling noise."
Maybe a wood thrush sounds like a recorder, maybe. Is that EOLA? And then it has a little trill at the end. I think I have a wood thrush number 13. It could potentially be it.
Could be it. Well, let's just play it. And Megan, here's our guess. It's a pretty song, too.
Mm-hmm.
We got tree frogs in the background there.
Yeah. Some tree frogs in the background. Mark in Green Bay is on next. Hi, Mark.
Oh, hi. Thanks for the opportunity.
Sure.
I've got some questions about purple martins. We've had a lot of predation by long-eared owls and great horned owls on our martin house this year. And the house, the design was supposedly a Purple Martin Association approved. So I'm wondering if you have any suggestions for the depth of the box, how deep it'd have to be so that the owls can't reach into it and snatch out the young.
Yeah, what is the box depth supposedly be? Is it more than 6 inches? Mm-hmm. 8 inches? What is it?
Well, these are 6x6.
Yeah. Well, I suppose it can't hurt to make them deeper to 8. But, yeah, I thought it was 6 or so. Yeah, if there's a platform outside, you know, a gourd house, for example, they're saying on a lot of bird houses now, they're saying don't put a perch on it. Don't put any kind of perch on it because predators can climb or sit on there. And so a traditional apartment house, if a great horned owl can perch and then reach in, there's no way they could do that to a gourd house, a martin gourd house, for example, because they'd have to flutter in air and reach their talon in somehow. And so that's one way to counter that. But, you know, a shorter porch, a deeper box would perhaps discourage that.
Yeah. And somebody, We were talking about purple martins one day on the show, and the expert said, "Yeah, that particular house is a we call those owl feeders." Purple martins.
Yeah, if you're looking to have owls in your backyard, then maybe get one of those. Yeah. Some people are happier with owls than purple martins.
Could I pursue the martin a little bit more here?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm curious to know where they mate and when they mate. We have a lot of swallows over here. They mate when they get back up north. We've never seen martins mating. Do they mate in the houses, or do they do it on their migration coming north?
No, they would. I had martin houses in the yard, and I did see some copulation on the wires in the house, but it'd be a little cramped, I think, in the nest box. But they probably are mating on the way up, but I think most of the bonding takes place at the site. I mean, the males and females.
It's just so quick. It's usually about 1 second, yeah. And if you have to be really paying attention there's a certain week of mating that is it's most common. I don't know what it is for purple martins, and I remember some days where it seems like every time I look up at a wire, I see a swallow mating, and then a couple weeks later, it becomes a lot harder. So maybe you're not looking at the right perfect time.
Hmm. All right.
Keep an eye out. Thanks for help.
Thanks a lot for calling. We have a Tim emailed us have what sounds like a pair of birds repeating a loud meow, which is coming from a river bottom. Any ideas there?
Yeah, a catbird is a likely answer to that, but that's a classic. That's why the bird is named that. It has kind of a meow call, and they would be in the woods in a river bottom. Otherwise, I hope it's not a feral cat. That would be bad for the birds.
Yeah, that would be very bad for the birds. Well, we have, let's see, what's our number there?
57 if you want to play some catbird.
All right, let's just try that. All right, here we go.
It's a very... There goes.
Meow. That is the catbird for sure. Well, Judy and Lodi, thank you for waiting. Hi.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Okay, I used to live over by Crystal Lake, and we've got a nest of eagles over there. And last week, they were all out, the male, the female, and there were two young of their, siblings. And isn't it kind of uncommon for them to be there for the summer?
Where is this?
Over by Crystal Lake in Lodi.
Mm-hmm.
Because all the water is overflowing, there's water all over Fish Lake, Mud Lake. Mm-hmm. They've had considerable flooding. But the nest has been there. I used to live there for about 26 years. And I saw them frequently, when the weather got cooler, they'd fly above the mobile homes or mm-hmm. campers or what have you. But 2 weeks ago and then 2 days ago, I was over there, and they were all sitting on top of something hard, either a log or, because I have my binoculars, I didn't have my camera.
Yeah, and any ideas here in this last minute?
The eagles would be more common near the Wisconsin River, but some years they expand, and a lot of the eagles in the Wisconsin River in that area near Lodi and Sauk City, some of them stay in the river and actually feed on fish, and there's a whole other population of eagles that actually go for carcasses that farmers throw out. So I'm wondering if they were sitting on a carcass if it was really far away, and then they'll just stay overnight, pick a tree, and maybe they can be miles away from the river itself when they actually go to sleep.
And by the way, Judy, the mnemonic for the eagle is picky, picky, pick up.
2-0.
Picky, picky, pick up.
Song if you want to play that.
All right. Well, I tell you what, we are out of time here. I'm trying to get that eagle up. And
one of the weakest songs for such a large bird. That's the eagle right there. Are we there?
Descend.
Well, and on that note, we have to close. Guys, it was great fun. How do we get copies of your DVD or your CD?
If you go to my website, caculo.com, CACULO.com, you can find all the information there.
All right. And Steve, your books and your new books will be out soon.
Yes. You can find my book, All This and Robins 2, at bookstores, or contact me at gonebirding88@hotmail.com.
Yeah, Steve's book is great for finding the best spots for looking for birds.
Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store.